And and many of the people who come to this meeting are also members of the ACMP.
Yes.
It's a different kind of organization. It's very difficult to get into, actually. I view addiction work as part of the field of psychopharmacology, and as a matter of fact, some of my research is really with schizophrenia and depression anyway.
Yeah, I'm curious about ACNP. I'm going to go. I've been in contact with Oakley Ray, and I'm going to go and sort of assess what they've got and how they've got it cataloged. It's not, I can't tell what's there from afar.
No, I would imagine it's really difficult because I never have seen a transcript of my interview.
Yeah.
It was actually videotaped as well.
Where was it? Plus, there's the problem of substance abuse research or addiction research specific. Right, so that's what we're trying to do, is sort of get an archive that would be substance abuse addiction research specific. That's the idea
behind
this project.
Have you tested the tapes this way? Because there's so much background noise here.
It's going to be fine.
Yeah.
It's so good. I'll tell you, my transcriber, I did an interview last year with Jack Henningfield with his son Victor playing the piano in the background.
Really?
And the transcriber was driven, I think, a bit crazy by this one, but that was the only one. So there's high ambient noise. That's why we have an interview room for most of them, but this is actually the only one I'm doing. It'll be fine.
Okay.
This is very sensitive mic. It'll
good.
Be fine. So let's sort of start then with your pathway into addiction research. In other words, give me a little bit of a narrative of how you got into substance abuse specific, and go ahead and add in psychopharmacology as a route too.
Okay. Well, in my case, I had had some training in addiction while I was a resident at the University of Pennsylvania. And this was about the time that the first methadone program was starting in Philadelphia. This was in the late 1960s. But my interest really increased when I was drafted into the military during the Vietnam War. And I was the head of a psychiatric unit at the Philadelphia Naval Hospital. One of the major reasons for my patients being unfit for duty was because of drug abuse, which provoked other kinds of psychiatric problems. And it was a lot of heroin and a lot of hallucinogens at the time. And so that got me interested in this area because it was so clinically important and there was so little science at the time. This was 1969 to 71. So I was recruited by the head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania, his name is Mickey Stunkard, to start a substance abuse program at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. So I applied for and designed one of the first VA programs to deal with the returning veterans, and this was also during the 1972 presidential campaign. Richard Nixon was really worried about this possibly causing him to lose the election because so many American boys were coming back with drug problems. And so this is why they put some money into it. Because of Mickey's help, I was able to fly around the country in my Navy uniform, actually, and get 50% off my airfares and go and visit with Vincent Dole and Jerry Jaffe and places, where they were doing work at the time. And I could see that they really needed science in this. So that's why I started a program based on science in Philadelphia.
Can you describe for me the state of scientific knowledge at that time?
Well, the major science as far as heroin addiction was concerned was that methadone was apparently a very effective treatment, but there was a lot of controversy about it, and there were practically no methadone programs around the country. There were very few, and there was a lot of resistance from the government, the DEA especially, or they were called the BNDD, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs at the time, and the FDA as well.
I saw you.
We had a lot of resistance. So I started the methadone program at the Philadelphia VA.
Okay.
And it was Jerry Jaffe, at that time became the drug czar under Nixon and changed the rules somewhat so that it became easier to start a methadone program. So that was the first major thing that we did. And the second major thing that we did in Philadelphia was we started to use computers to computerize all of our, because at that time, it was 1973, of course there was no such thing as a laptop or a desktop, but they did have mainframe computers, and I became a University of Pennsylvania faculty member, and each faculty member got what was called funny money, which was essentially a script that you could use to get time on the big Wharton School computer. So that's how we started organizing our program, because I could see that there was so much data there that you really needed to organize it in some way.
And so tell me, did you know at that point, I mean, your research priority was really methadone?
Well, my research priority actually became very early on what is addiction, the mechanisms of addiction, and I was very much influenced by reading the literature and reading Abraham Wickler's work.
Yes, so tell me more about that. What attracted you to Wickler's work in particular?
Well, it seemed to me that it was very novel way to look at addiction. At that time, it seemed more as a weak character and things like that. And Wickler, when he was at Lexington, had observed people that looked as though maybe they had conditioned responses. And he demonstrated conditioning in animals. So I decided that I would study human beings, and I did the first work demonstrating that craving was a conditioned response, withdrawal was a conditioned response, and this is how we came to the idea that addiction is a chronic disease, because it's a memory. It's not a brain lesion, but it's a very much overlearned memory, like learning how to ride a bicycle or play the piano.
Why didn't Wickler make that jump, given that he had access to human beings?
Well, I don't know. He was very helpful to me because I wrote to him very early on and told him what I wanted to do, and he wrote back and thought it was a great idea, but he only studied rats, actually, and he talked to people, but he only did experiments on rats, and so I was the first one to do experiments in human beings on this, and I was influenced by, Wickler had been influenced by Pavlov, who did the first work on conditioning of drug effects. And then subsequently after Wickler, Bob Schuster and Steve Goldberg did some work in animals. And so what I did essentially was design in Philadelphia something like they have in Russia. Actually, by coincidence, I got invited to Russia along with a VA delegation, and I visited some of Pavlov's students.
And when was that?
That was 1974. And so essentially, in order to do my conditioning, I set up a chamber within a room so that you could control sound and temperature and so forth.
I'll have the Florida grouper.
Grilled black and fried.
Black and
drink.
Water's fine.
And I will have a crab cake salad and a glass of iced tea and a basket of bread or something.
I'll have a glass of iced tea too.
I'll take the check.
Thanks. All right. So tell me something about, as I understand it, Wickler's Pavlovian-derived work is somewhat different from the Skinnerian-derived work, really, of Schuster, etc.
Well, actually, Wickler believed, and I think he was right, that memory is memory. And at that time, there were a lot of divisions between Skinnerians and Pavlovians. Even among psychologists that I recruited, they were having these little wars. You don't hear much about that anymore because the focus of memory now is on the biology of memory, starting with, Eric Kandel got the Nobel Prize for this, actually, recently. And it involves the fact that there are changes in synaptic construction, really. Memory is a physical change in the brain. And clearly, my patients have a memory that won't go away. And when I show them cues that are associated with addiction, they develop craving, they have blood pressure, pulse, respiration changes, and in the past 10, 15 years, we've been able to demonstrate that they have brain changes, which they can't control. So when they are in the brain imaging chamber and we show them a video of people using drugs, there's a reflex that goes on. We see brain activation. It's not something that you can command off by saying just no. You know, it's very difficult, especially these people have trouble controlling it, and they have trouble with impulses anyway. So, you know, this is beyond Skinnerian and Pavlovian, just totally beyond.
Okay. All right, so let's, I know you're there now, but I go back and...
Excuse me, I'm just going to say something to him as he passes by. Let me just tell him.
Sorry, Elaine, we're going to have a little interruption here. It's going to go on for a little while because we're in this restaurant. You don't have to transcribe any of this, obviously. Just saying hi.
Working on a proposal for the Winter Conference on Brain Research. Okay, good. So, and I'm right up against the deadline, as usual.
All right, so I want to take you back to that sort of controversy in the field around various types of behaviorism and describe for me what that was about.
Well, as far as addiction was concerned, the question is, what is the relative importance of avoiding withdrawal versus seeking pleasure? And so what I showed very clearly was that withdrawal could be conditioned as a Pavlovian response. So, you know, I would expose them to a neutral stimulus like an odor of oil of peppermint, and that didn't provoke any changes. And then I would pair that odor with naloxone, which provoked withdrawal, and then I would then give them just the odor by itself, which formerly did nothing, and now it provoked withdrawal, teary in the eyes, runny nose. This is why when people go back to an area where they use drugs, they go into withdrawal and they develop craving at the same time. On the other hand, it was very clear that they also were engaged in drug-seeking behavior. They wanted to get high. You asked them, what they really wanted was to get high. And we did a lot of studies letting them inject opiates in the laboratory. So this was another important part of my research, where I actually got permission through the Human Studies Committee. As a matter of fact, I had someone who was a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps, a Jewish sociology professor who reviewed all my work along with the committee and had great questions about it, but in fact agreed that...
Who was that?
Otto Pollack was his name. He's now deceased, but Otto Pollack was a survivor of the Nazi concentration camps, and he had to be convinced that what I was doing was not just human experimentation, that because these people got sick. In other words, and even thereafter, for months afterwards, when they smelled peppermint, they got sick. So it was a clear demonstration that this was a Pavlovian response.
And when was this study published?
It was throughout the 1970s. The most important publication was in Science in 1977. Now everybody does it with brain imaging because, you know, it's very it's been replicated dozens of times. Several papers here at this meeting, I think.
So do you regard that as one of your main sort of conceptual contributions to the field?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I freely admit that it was built on the animal work, but it had to be translated into human studies.
And of what those studies, which would you say it's most based upon?
Well, he did several studies in rats in which he would let them go into withdrawal, and the withdrawal was in a specific environment, and then when he put them out in that environment, when they weren't in withdrawal, they would start showing withdrawal signs like wet dog shakes. These are rats, and this is what a rat does when it's an opiate withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
He also had some reports of observing addicts in group therapy, and when they talked about getting high, they started showing signs of withdrawal, like yawning and all that. And they would tell stories about how when they were almost all from New York City, and when they went home to New York after their sentence was up, they would start getting sick, even though they hadn't had opiates in a long time. So, you know, these anecdotes gave me courage that I would find something, and it turned out to be a very robust phenomenon.
And those anecdotes were from Lexington.
Correct.
And how did... So you were basically reading these studies? You didn't go to Lexington or talk?
No, later I got invited to speak at Wickler's retirement symposium, and I gave a talk about it there. And also Wickler came and visited me in Philadelphia. I had him give a lecture in Philadelphia. And you know, we became very good friends. But mostly corresponded by letter, sort of old-fashioned. You know, there was no email, so we were writing letters back
and forth. So did he really see you as a kind of heir apparent to his scientific work?
Yes, he did. As a matter of fact, that's kind of interesting that you would say that, because when he died, when I would see him at meetings, he was really failing. You know, he had really bad peripheral vascular disease, and so you had to walk very slow with him, because when he walked, his legs would really start hurting. And but we would have, you know, talks about things, and he was really intrigued with what I was doing, because at that time I was putting people on a narcotic antagonist and then having them inject, try to extinguish the, you know, I mean, it turned out to be not practical. It was a dead end in a way, but it was something that had to be done.
You were trying to get them away from the needle as a cue.
That's right, and trying to extinguish the conditioned response, just the way you would extinguish, say, a phobia or something like that. And anyway, so when he died, I wrote a letter to his wife for condolence, saying that, you know, he was kind of my scientific father, and she wrote back and said that he really much considered you his scientific heir, son, or something like that. She was very kind. You know, it was a very, very nice thing. Yeah, so it was really a situation where, you know, there was this you know, intellectual sort of passing of the torch, really. Because I think that he must have wished that he could have done some of the studies that I was doing. And I can't tell you why he never did them, except that, you know, it was easier to do animal studies.
But he had a human population there.
That's right, he did.
Do you think it was a...
You met Conan Kornetsky, you probably interviewed him already.
Your little film clip I had?
Yes, yeah.
The reason I put that in, because of you.
Yeah, that was a great...
You remember you said you never really understood
that's
it
right,
you saw
absolutely.
It in my lab?
I told that
so
to,
I said, we'll make a picture of it.
I told that to George, too, because he's been talking about it for years, but the way he described it, I was getting it wrong. I was thinking the rats were going up or down, and, you know, that's why I thought the wheel was...
No.
Now I
understand. It's a
you
wheel
just move the wheel.
Wheel,
and it just keeps
in
going
around
and around.
The rat, you can see the wheel bigger, but the mouse, the wheel was... sort of small, so you can't...
Yeah, no, that was very good.
But you notice how quickly that red light came on?
Yeah.
Well, he really...
That's right.
He really goes for it.
And I had been there in your lab watching it, actually. So
that's why I put it in, because of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, so let's see. Wickler, now...
Yeah, so basically that we would... We tried very hard to extinguish it, and I think that was important. But I became convinced after all that work that you had to have medications. So that's why I think medication development is so important.
And what convinced you of that? Just watching that behavior not do enough to extinguish, or
that the behavior is too overlearned to be extinguished that way.
Right. Could you explain overlearning?
Well, overlearning refers to behavior that is so ingrained. You've done it so many times. Jimmy Connors hitting a tennis ball, or a great pianist, you know, his fingers over the keys. And unlearning is impossible when something built, you know. I mean, it's basically a permanent change in the brain. You probably learned how to ride a bicycle when you were 7 or 8 years old, and you rode for a few years, and you may not have touched a bicycle in the past 20 years, but chances are you can get right on a bicycle and ride away right now. On the other hand, if you had been living on an island somewhere where there were no bicycles, and now at your age you were first put on a bicycle, it would take you a while to learn how to do it. That you can't unlearn your experience, your expertise on a bicycle. It's there. It's a change in your brain.
Is overlearning habit?
Sure, that's another way of looking at it. But if, you know, more specifically, you know, there is a pathway that has been facilitated, and there's a structural change in the nerve fibers. This is, as Eric Kandel says when he gives a talk, if you pay attention during this talk, in an hour from now, you will have different sprouting of your dendrites and different facilitation of your synapses. In other words, an actual physical change. Memory is a physical change. And if it's a very overlearned memory, it's not going to go away. It's going to stay there perhaps forever for the rest of your life.
All right, so now let's return to the time period when you're doing the Pavlovian sort of studies is what, like?
Throughout the, you know, from about 1972 to 82, or, you know, even now, I mean, we're still doing those studies, but we're doing it more with brain imaging and medications.
Okay, so
in about 1980, Anna Rose Childress joined me.
Yes.
And we've been working together ever since. And in the late 70s, Tom McClellan joined me. And another area of my research that I had started with George Woody was treatment studies. And very early, I recognized that the field needed a treatment measure. And NIDA gave a symposium at Reston, Virginia, for a couple of days, and I was asked to present on measurement of addiction. And what I said was that we need an addiction severity index, and it has to do more than what they were doing at the time, which was just measure the number of bags of heroin per day, or the number of ounces of absolute alcohol, or grams of cocaine. And I said we needed a multidimensional addiction severity index. And I started a series of seminars in Philadelphia. One of the people I invited was, besides Jim Mintz, who was the psychologist working with me at the time, I invited Tom McClellan, who was at that time at Coatesville, VA. And then Jim left to go to California, and so I hired Tom, and he took over the addiction severity index, and he's built it into the most important measure of addiction today. Everybody uses it. It's translated into about 20 different languages.
And how is it different from other measures like the ARC inventory?
Totally different. Totally, totally different. The ARC inventory is simply drug effects. Like, do you feel stimulated, depressed, tired, or whatever? No, this is a 7-dimension index of the need for treatment. So there's a drug measure, an alcohol measure, a family, occupational, social, health, medical, and psychiatric. And it's a structured interview, and the way Tom has worked out, and it's in its 6th iteration now. We keep improving it, and it's actually computerized. It will now generate a narrative actually that is acceptable for JCHO inspections, you know, and you know, because it's, in other words, it's become part of the electronic medical record, so to speak. But it all started in the 1970s with this NIDA symposium at Reston, Virginia, you know, where I proposed this and got it started in Philadelphia. Now it's just spread all over the place.
So how have you seen your research priorities and NIDAs have been pretty well aligned over the course of your career?
Sure, but that's not an accident. NIDA has used people like me as consultants, and for the most part, you know, they've listened to us. So I've been giving advice to NIDA since the early 70s, since NIDA was born.
Were you on the advisory council in the beginning?
Well, you know, first I was on the study section, and when I became chairman of the study section, and I became on the board of scientific counselors for the intramural program, and, you know, they just went.
Yeah.
I became on the council, and also at that time there was a DAMHA, which was the, you know, Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Administration. I was on that board too, and then after my term expired on the council in the 1990s, then I went back to being on a study section, which is the Center's Review Committee. And that's what I'm on right now.
But
there've also been many
days,
retreats,
Ida.
And oh, there's also been the various committees I've been on that are advisory to the director of NIDA. Every director back to Bob DuPont, Bill Pollan, Bob Schuster, Alan Leshner, and I've also been on the committees that have selected the last few, I even have been urged to accept the job myself, but I never really wanted to. I think I'm doing more, you know, in Philadelphia than I would have done there, and of course I've also proposed Nora Volkoff for the job. So my research priorities in NIDAS have been very much intertwined over the years. And when you get a chance, could you bring some more lemons, please?
More lemons?
Yep.
So can you tell me what I'd like you to do is basically give me a narrative about how the research priorities have evolved over the years. So maybe start with the early days of NIDA.
Well, probably, by the way, you should know that I have always been interested in alcohol as well. My patients do not make the distinction between alcohol and other drugs.
Indeed.
So I've been doing research on alcohol since the 1970s, and I've given a lot of advice to NIAAA as well. And the Alcohol Institute, though, has had more influence on the sort of non-biological approach, whereas NIDA has always been a little more accepting of the idea that that addiction is very much a biological phenomenon.
And is that because of the dominance of AA, recovery-oriented disorders?
Yes, that's right. But just to give you an idea, when I first started my VA program, Congress had already passed a law, the civil service or whatever, that you didn't need a college degree to work as a counselor in a program and get a pretty high GS rating if you were an ex-addict. So somehow they were setting in stone, you know, that being a former addict was somehow qualification to make you a therapist, which we studied this, and it's not true at all. It's not true at all. And there's a high relapse rate among ex-addict counselors. And the same is true of recovering alcoholics. It's not popular to say that even now, but it was very controversial back then. But, I mean, it was very obvious because of the problems that we had with with employees. And it was really a hard thing for them to do, too. They needed a different kind of a job, and they needed to go to school.
And you've seen that happen?
Yeah.
We've now professionalized and credentialized to a greater
degree. It's much better. Yeah. So in the early days, you had to get people to accept data. But, everything has evolved. I mean, the field of psychiatry has evolved, too. But initially, I set up the treatment program pretty much like a psychiatry residency. And I started hiring MDs and PhDs with clinical training and master's degrees, and, gradually professionalizing our program. And we had a very enriched program so that, when people studied treatment programs, we had always more professionals than any other program, but we also had better treatment outcomes as well.
So do you hear that paraprofessional-professional sort of divide? You still hear it?
You hear it, I think, more in the Betty Ford sort of thing. Now we have effective treatments, and I have a hard time getting them accepted, even by the very expensive private program. And what I tell them, I have a spiel that I can talk to these people a lot. And I say, look, I am a clinician, I'm a therapist, and I believe that I have the responsibility to get the best treatment for my patients. And I think it would be unethical for me to deprive my patients of the option of getting effective medication, because I'm not saying medication by itself is enough, but in combination with psychotherapy, it's the best treatment that we have available. And I just think that I couldn't ethically deprive them of that. Because some of them just say, I don't believe in medication. Well, where does that leave their patient?
It's a very basic hostility towards medication.
Right.
So you have always seen your research as clinically applicable, as translatable.
Right. That's the whole idea. That's the motivation behind it. I think one of the reasons we've been successful in getting grants even is that I always try to develop research ideas and test hypotheses based on the impact that it'll have in treatment. So, you could just go on and on about all the studies that we've done over the years. I don't do studies just for the fun of it, but I try to do it with the idea that it might improve treatment.
Have you had I'm sure you've experienced the sort of gap that NIDA has tried to bridge, that sort of research as one culture, treatment as another. Have you seen that change over time?
I think the Clinical Trials Network has helped a lot.
How do you think that gap came into being?
Well, partly it was neglect on the part of the medical profession, not getting into the field of addiction. There was an interesting article some years ago in the Sunday Times magazine by a writer writing about his psychoanalysis. He said, I saw this analyst 4 times a week for 8 years or so. Meanwhile, I was drinking myself through 2 marriages, ruining my job, my liver, and everything. And he never wanted to hear about my drinking. He never really cared. That was never the topic of anything. And I realized that, he totally ignored the biggest problem of my life with his psychoanalysis. I mean, it was totally irrelevant to his real problems. And he was very bitter in this article. And I teach a course. It's a required course of all medical students at the University of Pennsylvania. 150 students a year. On addiction, 25-hour course with a tough final exam. And part of the course involves inviting in people from AA to talk to the students about the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and invite the students to an AA meeting. And I tell them that AA is something that we should all be very proud of, because it's an American invention. It was created by a GP and a salesman. It's spread all over the world in every language. It only helps people. It doesn't hurt people. It's not a weapon. It doesn't make money for anybody. It's something, you know, it's pure altruism, and it's one thing that America can be totally proud of. And it should be a partner to physicians. So I want them to know how to refer patients to AA. And, you know, so I think we have to bridge that gap, and it's bridgeable, but it's been there for many years.
And is that course, in terms of medical education in the addictions, unusual?
Very much.
So that physicians going through that would not have access to that same kind of education in the addictions elsewhere?
I do not know of any other school that has a course like that.
All right, so tell me about your developing interest in medications. You're actually quite unusual. You're somewhat unusual in that you've integrated so many of the various different sort of knowledge-producing areas and philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you really integrate behaviorism,
mm-hmm.
Pavlovian, mm-hmm. you know, with neuroscience, with recovery, sort of spiritual recovery.
Right.
What makes that kind of integration possible?
I guess it's pragmatism. I mean, you know, I think that any good doctor will try to do whatever they can to help their patient. You don't say, I'm only going to work with this or that. As a matter of fact, I teach my residents in psychiatry that you don't have to consider yourself just a psychoanalyst or just a pharmacologist. I do group therapy, family therapy. I've done hypnotherapy. I do amatol interviews. You know, it's also because this isn't all that difficult. In other words, I feel qualified in all of these areas, and it's no big deal to me. And I try to convince other psychiatrists that they can do this. Sometimes, though, psychiatrists know nothing about medication, and so there'll be some of these guys who refer a patient to me, please put this patient on lithium. I mean, I think this is a disgrace. They don't know how to use lithium, but that's true of some doctors. Fewer and fewer now. The young doctors are, you know, much more.
When did you... Do you see your more psychopharmacology research trajectory? How does it... how is it related to your substance abuse research trajectory? So at what point do you become interested in schizophrenia, depression?
Well, my first clinical research was on schizophrenia. And so I did a study of the use of group therapy versus individual therapy and medications. And it was very clear that medications were very useful. But, you know, I did a randomized controlled clinical trial of schizophrenia while I was still a resident. I also did a residency in neurology and psychiatry, so I'm board certified in neurology too. So I've always had an interest in the brain. My PhD is in neurophysiology.
So, returning to the... when you look at your career, do you see different epochs when certain approaches are more dominant than others? So do you see a behaviorist, you know, sort of moment, and then a neuroscience-oriented moment, or is the brain always there?
It's been pretty consistent. The only thing that's changed is the technology. First of all, it was the advent of computers, the advent of brain imaging. So the technology has changed. But I did the first double-blind controlled trial of a psychoactive medication in addiction, and published in 1974, I think. So it goes back a long time.
And that was what? medication?
It was doxycycline, an antidepressant for depression in heroin addicts who were on methadone. So it was George Woody and Carl Ruckles and I did the study in my program.
And when did you start integrating scans? When did those technologies begin to come into your lab?
Late 80s. I got a grant that involved SPECT scanning in 1987.
And in order to do that, what did you have to do? What did you have to learn?
Well, I've had to learn what are the limitations and what is something about the physics and the mechanisms. And I have a very large center, many different projects, and so I try to assign different projects to different investigators. So I introduced Anna Rose Childress to the brain imaging field, and then she's taken off with it. So she specializes in that. I just don't have the time to work on that every day. Anna Rose works on it every day, and she's learned a lot about the various kinds of brain imaging, and she interacts on a daily basis with the radiologists and nuclear medicine physicians. And she's an interesting person for you to talk to as well.
We sort of missed on our appointment, but I would like to come to Philadelphia. I would like to actually, I'd be interested in whether...
George Woody?
Yeah.
Tom McCall?
Yeah. See, I haven't got into your sort of research cluster yet, and I'd like to use it as a research site in an NSF grant that looks more at the sort of social organization of the current field.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll send you that grant and let you look and see if you think it would be. I think it would be an excellent research site, actually, the more I talk to you, because you're actually somebody. I was going to ask you a question that's about the sort of succession of methodologies and technologies that are used in the field, but it sounds to me like what you are describing is less a succession and more of a sort of incorporation of what has been known. And bringing it into, say, neuroscience. Do you have geneticists also?
Yes. Wade Baratini, who's giving a talk at 2 o'clock, actually.
Yeah.
Because actually one of our most important recent papers is a pharmacogenetics paper on the treatment of alcoholism. We found an allele of the mu opiate receptor that has a greater affinity for beta endorphin. It increases the risk of alcoholism and heroin addiction. And in the alcoholics who have this allele, if they get randomly assigned to placebo, they do very poorly, but randomly assigned to naltrexone, they do extremely well. So what the implication is that in the future, doctors will be able to genotype their patient and select the medication based on genotype.
So can you tell me about future implications of pharmacogenetics and where you see the field going? And did you have to also learn genetics? I mean, all of that in order...
Well, I mean, I wish I knew more about genetics, but I certainly have learned a lot more about genetics than I used to know. And I'm teamed with an outstanding geneticist, Wade Baratini. So, I mean, that's, I think, what modern medical research is all about. No one person can be an expert in all these fields, but they can recognize expertise in other people, and they can learn enough to be a user. I mean, I know enough about imaging to be a user, or enough about genetics to be a user, and work with a full-fledged geneticist.
Yeah, in a way, it's addiction research has long been highly interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm.
Do you sense any... For some, the coming of neuroscience or the coming of genetic approaches, pharmacogenetics, can be somewhat threatening. It doesn't sound like you're at all threatened. You're, in fact, very interested in moving the field in those directions.
Sure.
Any idea what makes the difference? And do we have the sort of research infrastructure in place to enable that progression?
Well, I think so. I think NIDA has done a very good job in fostering all these things. They have a great medication development program. They have a wonderful genetics program. They really make it easy for us to collect samples and send to this central lab that they have.
This is George Rules?
No, this is actually, well, I mean, he's had something to do with it, but we send them to a place in New Jersey where they extract DNA and make a perpetual sample that can be used for the future. NIDA pays for that.
So was NIDA late on genetics compared to the alcohol field, or would you not say that?
Well, by its nature, other drugs besides alcohol are difficult to study the genetics of because the availability is so different. So the phenotype is variable, whereas everybody has access to alcohol and have had for generations. So I wouldn't say that NIDA has been really late, although certainly they've gotten more into it in recent years. But I think it was appropriate, and now that we have tools and we have the Human Genome Project, it makes more sense.
So you see it as the becoming available of the tools, of the technologies,
mm-hmm.
that enables the field to mm-hmm. move, rather than the driving sort of questions. I mean, how do the basic questions that motivate your research, have they changed over time, or are you still basically trying to answer questions you began with?
Well, trying to answer similar questions. The problem changes. There's much more stimulant addiction now than before. We're also very heavily into nicotine addiction. That's always been there, but there weren't medications before. I think that's a very important area that NIDA has taken over. I see sort of a smooth transition, but as I look back and try to respond to your question, there is a lot of similarity between the broad questions that we're working on today and what I worked on 30 years ago.
And do you think that you share that with other prominent researchers in the field? In other words, has your capacity to shape what NIDA does, being so involved on the advisory councils and in the study sections, etc., has that meant that, in effect, the field is doing what you're doing? And who do you share that with?
I mean, which other investors?
Yeah.
In terms of centers of drug abuse research, it's very obvious that the major hotbeds are places like Yale and Hopkins and Penn, and now Columbia, just Berkeley removed there, and UCLA, and then other places are also good, but maybe not as intense. San Francisco or San Diego. But they're the first ones that I named have been in the business a long time and are also very diverse.
Yes.
We have major projects going in all the serious addictions.
Right, it's striking actually about this field. I gather that it sort of attracts and holds people who are able to be fairly integrated in terms of discipline and methodology.
It's also a very friendly field. there was once an article in Science in the last couple of years about how dog eat dog the geneticists are. But we help one another. We collaborate a lot.
Yeah. And what do you think accounts for that?
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with the fact that it's a field that has had to sort of fight for respect in the medical school, you know, as opposed to cardiology, immunology, things like that.
So in a way, external lack of respect has sort of made the field more cohesive, perhaps.
That's speculation.
Have you seen the respect level change over the time that you've been involved in the field?
Yeah. People have told me that. That's the sort of thing that I hear when people introduce me to an auditorium, you know, about, because I think that we gain respect because people have done good science, and that's how, you know, I mean, we have a lot of people in the addiction field who are members of the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology, which is an honorific organization. Some of us are in the Institute of Medicine, National Academy of Sciences. And so, you know, we get elected to those positions. I got elected to be president of ACNP. So, you know, I think that obviously we've got some respect. And I have all this time in the medical school curriculum, which is a very interesting story, actually. Because when I first came to Penn, the students came to me and asked me to teach an elective course on addiction because they didn't know anything about it. They were trying to, in those days, help undergraduates who were getting bad trips. And so I started an elective course, which a fair number of students would take. But still, all elective courses get a small percentage of the class. And in the late 80s, Penn reevaluated its curriculum. The reevaluation consisted of a faculty retreat to which they invited recent medical school graduates. And so we asked the graduates, what was it that you didn't learn in your 4 years of medical school that you wish you had learned now that you're out and trying to treat patients? And, you know, they talked about maybe treatment of congestive heart failure. We should have had more of that. But the most common thing they said was, we see all these patients with substance abuse and we didn't learn that unless we took Dr. O'Brien's elective. So naturally, I jumped on that. We were totally redesigning the curriculum. So I got inserted in there a course on addiction, a comprehensive course, which was correlated with the pharmacology course. And it has, you know, lectures and seminars. I have videotapes interviewing patients. They actually they have to do a patient workup, and they meet these AA people, and so it's required, and it gets very high grades from the students, and I think it's going to stay there for a while, which is really good. But time in the curriculum is like the most precious thing. So the fact that we got that is a good sign.
Yeah.
I wish other schools would do the same thing.
So, but that would take sort of reform of medical education, I suppose, to get that to happen. So you hear the Institute of Medicine and the National Academies have both released reports in the mid-90s about the field failing to attract sort of quality people on a number of different levels. What do you make of that? Do you think that's changed by now?
Not enough. No, it's I run a postdoctoral research training program, and I can attract a lot of good PhDs, but very few MDs. there are reasons for that, but you know, the MDs mostly want to learn clinical work. They don't have as much interest in research. They have big educational loans, so there are problems. So I think we should be doing better. And I even talked about that at the board meeting last night, actually, here, that we ought to be doing affirmative action on MDs because, and minorities as well. Just look around, you don't see many minorities here, and not in high places either. It's true in science in general, but I've always made great effort to try to attract minorities into my program.
Have you been successful?
Marginally. I mean, I've got the first two African-Americans in the history of the University of Pennsylvania into the senior faculty status at Penn. A few years ago, the first one and then the second one. But there's still very few. And I also got a medical student fellowship program for minority students that come and train. One of my former medical students is here. He's now a postdoctoral fellow. He's Hispanic, but I've been doing my best. But I recommended, I said also that this whole college has become already dominated by PhDs, very few MDs. So for the Young Investigator Award, there's been one MD in the past 20 years. We won it in the board last night. There were three MDs out of 19 PhDs. I mean, you can see the ratio. But early on, there was a high percentage of MDs in this college. So I just said, that we ought to be doing something to attract more MDs and more minorities.
So that's obviously a future direction. What else do you see as where you're going next? I mean, the kind of research that needs to be done, the kinds of questions that need to be asked and answered.
I think that we have to keep working on what is this memory that constitutes addiction, molecular or biological. Can we address it more specifically? We haven't talked about naltrexone, which was one of the most important things that I did, and I think that's moved along very well. It was developed to treat heroin addiction, and most heroin addicts won't have anything to do with it. But at this meeting in 1979, there was a paper by Hal Altshuler which showed that rhesus monkeys could be trained to self-inject alcohol. About half of them. I mean, most of them. You don't have much time left. Most of them don't like alcohol. He got them to inject alcohol, and then he was trying to figure out what the endogenous opioid system did. So he gave them small doses of naltrexone, and it blocked their drinking of alcohol in a dose-related way. So I saw that paper, and I thought, that may mean that alcoholism has something to do with the endogenous opioid system. So I went home, and I had a MD PhD student named Joe Vocacelli who was studying rats with foot shock stress and the effect that had on alcohol drinking. And so I gave him some of my naltrexone from my heroin addict patients, and it blocked the alcohol drinking in these animals as well. So eventually I got this added to my IND that I could treat alcoholics, and I found that some alcoholics were incredibly improved by taking naltrexone. To make a long story short, now it was approved by the FDA, it was replicated by other people, being used all over the world, and now there's a depot preparation that's being reviewed by the FDA, and I think that's going to make it much more useful.
So that's a very interesting example of pretty quick translation from the animal studies into treatment.
Well, you could argue that it still isn't there, because so many people, especially the ex alcoholic counselor, don't believe in it. I had a patient's husband call me not too long ago, whose wife had been admitted to a really fine treatment program. They call themselves the Betty Ford of the East, where I'm on the board, and I've been telling them about medications for years, and all the senior people agree with me. This woman goes in, she gets detoxified, she's a really bad case of alcoholism. And her husband says, what about putting him on naltrexone? And the counselor said, no, I don't believe in that. She doesn't need that. So she goes out, and within 2 weeks, she's right back where she started from, all over again. So he brings her back there, and this time he insists, and now she's fine. She hasn't, you know, it's really worked.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they
so
just, even though their bosses have been saying, yes, do this, you know, and I've been giving lectures out there, when it's actually, you know, where the rubber meets the road, you know, the counselor to the patient, they're still blocking it.
Yeah. What do you think it will take to change that?
Time, I guess.
Better counselor education.
Yeah. I'm trying to shame them. I try to point out to them that we evaluate programs. This is Tom McClellan's specialty. The good programs are not necessarily the most expensive, but they tend to be people who are better trained and more flexible, and they actually tailor the treatment to the patient. But I keep trying to convince them that just because one system worked for you when you were recovering doesn't mean that it's going to work for all of your patients. And you know, that's the concept that I've tried to sell, and you know, with some success, but not total.
Let me give you a little bit of optimism. I, for another project, have been doing focus groups with the frontline workforce, and what has struck me is the extent to which people in recovery now say things like, "When I went to get, you know, further training, I realized that my knowledge was limited, and that science, and they always use, it's like science is the lever, you know, science is what opens the door, and they begin to realize that their experience is not enough, and they even say things like, I realized that I was completely, enthusiasm is not enough, experience is not enough, so the message is getting out there. But I think you're right. I mean, there's been this extensive stranglehold, you know, for a pretty long time. But I think the field is shifting, and it is around science, and especially brain science, neuroscience, because they always turn to that stuff. And they say, now science is, you know, has more relevance to what, you know, what our experience has been. I should go. Thank you for all of that. Sorry it was so rushed. But